Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Guy James Show. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. We hope to have a good show for you. And got a great guest coming up at the bottom of the hour. We have Chris Gunn, who's the communications director for the American Small Business League, and we're going to talk about how Bush and his gang are, they're ruining the SBA loan program for people. As you know, it's no longer for small business since Bush got in. Big business has taken over the SBA and getting a lot of the money, and therefore the small business folks, ma and pa stores that tried to get loans for SBA and all that can't do it anymore. So anyway, we're going to talk about that at the bottom of the hour. Welcome. I hope you had a good weekend, a good 4th of July weekend. Did you go out and party and do all that stuff? You probably went out and drove all over the place, burned lots of gas, bought lots of expensive steaks to barbecue and all that. I mean, steaks so cheap nowadays and all. Yes. Hey, you could join us here in the program today. 866-546-5254. We'd love to have you join in today. Speaking of expensive steaks, I noticed a while back, and then I saw a story today on MSNBC, pretty much nails down what I came home and told my wife the other day after going to the grocery store again. Perhaps all of you have noticed it as well. Have you noticed what they're calling this short sizing that's taking place? First, it started like with hot dogs and cold meat and so forth two or three years ago. No longer were the packages a pound, but they've suddenly shrunk to 14 ounces. And I actually had the grocer tell me, the Publix grocery store down the road from where I live, that, well, the reason they're doing that, and I love this one, the reason they're doing that is they found that there's less waste for families that way. Most people didn't use up the entire 16 ounces, and there was waste, so they cut it down to 14, and that's where it ought to be for the average family with no waste involved. Of course, they kept the price the same. And now, quoting off some of this MSNBC story, there's all sorts of products in the grocery store, and maybe you've noticed it. Have you taken a look at the Breyers ice cream? Breyers, a famous brand of ice cream, very good ice cream. I think it's excellent ice cream. But anyway, Dean Smith was looking at two containers of Breyers ice cream. They looked exactly the same at his supermarket in Evansville, Indiana. And then he looked closely, and he figured out that the old package was 1 3/4 quarts, and the new package was just 1 1/2 quarts. Mm-hmm. So they cut out a quarter quart there without... kept the price the same. And this practice is called short-sizing. And the consumer's websites, consumers.com, they call it shrink ray. It's hitting products all over the store. And it's just happening to all sorts of things. There's now about 10 ounces for your pound of coffee that used to be. And the ice cream I just mentioned. Breakfast cereals. Many, many breakfast cereals. They were... And you can go in the store and you can see the changeover sometime. You can see they still have the smaller or the larger box on the shelf and replacing it with the smaller one. Shredded wheat cereal, cut from 19 down to 18 ounces. The boxes were the same, as were the prices. Coco Magic went from 18 ounces to 16 ounces, kept the price the same. Even soap, Irish Spring, and Dial soap, they've been short-sized. Coco Krispies, Apple Jacks, Fruit Loops, Cheerios, Hellman's mayonnaise. Not so long ago was $4.89 for 32 ounces. Now it gets you 30 ounces for $4.89. You know what it boils down to? They're talking about, well, we had to shrink the packages. We had to do this because of our rising cost of transportation and all that. And there's another one, the corn. I noticed this one on a can of corn. It was 14 ounces, now it's 11 ounces, cost the same. You've seen what Campbell's Soup has done to theirs over the years. How small is a damn can of soup now from Campbell's Soup? Let's tell it what it is. Let's call it what it is. It's stealing. It's legalized theft, it's legalized deception, it's legalized fraud. That's exactly what it is. Giving you less for the same amount of money. Oh yes, it's on the package. What's in there? It is in the little teeny letters. It's on there. But you shouldn't have to go to the store and be wary of major manufacturers screwing you time after time after time. You shouldn't have to be wary of getting it in the old wazoo every time you go to the grocery store. Another package has been downsized while the price is staying the same. I actually had someone tell me a while back. No, I haven't noticed the prices go up that much. I haven't noticed them go up. Well, have you noticed you're getting less in the size of the products you're buying? I sure have. And maybe I sound like a Scrooge talking like that. Maybe I do. Have any of you noticed that as well? I don't know. I'm just very, very aware of prices in the grocery store. And it just bothers me when large companies who are paying big dividends to their shareholders and huge money to their CEOs of their companies and all, millions of dollars, are screwing you and me by giving us less product for our money and not telling us they're going to do it. There ought to be a sign right in the aisle. Hey, you know what? We just downsized this package. Instead, there probably is a sign somewhere. There ought to be a sign somewhere that says, buyer beware, because you're getting screwed even in the grocery store. It reminds me of sales tactics here in Florida. I don't know how many of you have it around. I do know, as a former resident of Ohio, the Attorney General's office in Ohio was a lot better at watching sales tactics of companies trying to screw you with small print and all. Here in Florida, you can do anything you want to. You can put fine print so small at the bottom, and I've done this, at the bottom of an ad, in the newspaper that it cannot be read with a magnifying glass. And yes, I wear reading glasses, but when I have to get a magnifying glass out to even try and read something, then you can't with the Same way with ads on TV. They run that disclaimer. They run it so fast that no human ears could ever understand what it says. Or the print so fine, so small at the bottom of the screen. Hey, you can buy a brand new Pontiac for only $149 a month. And down at the bottom, what it really says is it's a lease. And if it's you put $5,000 down and it's 72 months or, you know, all the fine print, you can't read it. You cannot read it on TV. And they're allowed to get away with this. I guess my whole point is, I'm mad as hell, and I don't want to take it anymore, and yet here we are every day as consumers and as citizens of this country getting screwed by the government, getting screwed by the companies, and everybody says, oh, I'm tired of you whining about it. Well, you know, when they're taking every last cent we have, when they're taking our rights away, well, all this, I mean, what's not to whine about? I mean, don't call it whining, I'm complaining. And it's just happening. It's just happening so regularly now that you get to expect it. You get to expect that whenever you go buy something, you're going to get screwed somehow. Stores that you go buy something and you get it home and it's not what they claimed it would be, and so you go to take it back. And I'll mention one of the big box stores. Have you gone into Best Buy? So they'll sue me. I don't care. Have you gone into Best Buy and bought anything and paid for it in cash, for example? And it's, I don't know, $300. You go back in to get your money back and say, we'll send you a check within 2 weeks? They tried that on me, and that's their store policy. I forget exactly what the details are, but it is their store policy not to give you your cash back, that they'll send you a check if it's over a certain amount. They'll send you a check. And they say, well, it's to protect you, the consumers. I don't know exactly how that works, but have you ever had that happen to you? I protested so loud and long in a Best Buy store that they finally surrendered and gave me my money back, but I know 90% of the people that go in there are going to have to wait for a check to get their own money back from a big box store. I should be a consumer advocate. I guess in a way I am. But it just is shocking to me how companies are taking advantage of the consumers left and right. Things aren't bad enough, but you have to watch out when you go to the grocery store. You have to go watch out no matter where you go. Make sure you're not getting screwed these days. Had an air conditioning service have to come to the studio here not too long ago, just a couple of weeks ago. And I should mention his name, and I think maybe tomorrow I will. I don't have it right here right now. But probably the most unsatisfactory, nasty screwing ever got by a tradesperson. And it's a well-known company around here. And they come in and they give your air conditioning system a total rejuvenation. Absolutely free. Should have known right there, shouldn't I? It was my fault. And then for a year, they'll come back and check out your air conditioning system. It just sounds like a terrific deal. Of course, when they get here, hey, did you know this was wrong with your air conditioner? Gosh, did you know this was bad with it? Ooh. And there's something else, and my oh my, these parts are, they're kind of expensive. And so the guy tears the air conditioning system all apart, puts it back together with several new parts. You ever have this happen to you? Plugs everything in, wires everything up, starts it up, and it won't run. And he looks at me and says, gosh, the motor is bad. I said, well, the motor wasn't bad. It was running when you got here. Yeah, but it won't run now. My goodness. He said, I know this looks bad. And I said, yeah, it does. I know this looks bad, but you need a new motor. This one's burnt up. And it was. Something he did, he wired it backwards or something, and he wired it so that it burned up. And he just looks at me with this look on his face. Well, you know, I know this looks bad, but it's quite a coincidence, and we have to sell you a new a new motor for $279. Just happened to have one in the truck. Just happened to have one of all the parts in the truck. Well, anyway, I've complained long and loud about it. Anyway, left here with this deal that was supposed to cost $99. It ended up costing $1,100. Yeah. Do you have any similar stories? I'll bet some of you do. Now, I want to take a moment. I want to take just a moment and, express my feelings about a citizen that passed away on July the 4th, former United States Senator Jesse Helms. And you may not like what I have to say, and you may think talking about the dead is a bad thing, but in this case it is not for me. Jesse Helms was a bad man. Jesse Helms was an avowed believer in black intellectual inferiority. He was a hysterical opponent of interracial marriage. He called the 1964 Civil Rights Act the single most dangerous piece of legislation ever introduced in the United States Congress. And said of civil rights demonstrators, he said this, "The Negro cannot count forever on the kind of restraint that's thus far left him free to clog the streets, disrupt traffic, and interfere with other men's rights." Helms' vision of civil rights for African American was that there should be none. And it confounds me that anyone, now or ever, ever looked up to this man. Ask the African American community about Jesse Helms. There are too numerous examples of Helms' outright hate to even mention. And wouldn't it be better for Bush and McConnell not to say a damn thing about him today? A patriot? Please. Election after election, the GOP moans about why, in staggering numbers, black folks despise their party and apparently would rather eat glass than vote the Republican way. And you only have to read the glorification of a bastard like Jesse Helms to know why they will never, ever support the Republican Party. And what made the famous Helms racist White Hands ad? Have you remember that White Hands ad? Let me see if I have it here. I think I do. Let's play this for you. This is an ad run by Jesse Helms, the man they're saluting today.
"I needed that job, and you were the best qualified. But they had to give it to a minority because of a racial quota. Is that really fair? Harvey Gantt says it is. Gantt supports Ted Kennedy's racial quota law that makes the color of your skin more important than your qualifications. You'll vote on this issue next Tuesday. For racial quotas, Harvey Gantt. Against racial quotas, Jesse Helms."
Yes, the great patriotic Jesse Helms, a man for all people. He made an unabashed racial appeal to white voters while he was shunning non-whites. You remember that voiceover? "You deserved that job, but they had to give it to a minority." That's clearly not speaking to the minority voters. And Helms could have run an ad that explained his view that racial references were unfair and asked all the voters, white and minority, to support him in opposing the policy. Instead, he runs an ad that told white people, "I'm on your side." And he told the minority, "Screw you, and I don't care what you think." And what about the blood on his hands of the nuns, since Helms loved him some right-wing Central American dictators? And don't forget he preceded Ronald Reagan and got things ready for him and the Republican hate party. There would not have been a President Ronald Reagan without Jesse Helms. And I know people may not appreciate me talking like about this, but his name should be an embarrassment. An embarrassment to the conservative movement. I certainly wouldn't want anything to do with a man like him. They looked at this guy as a leader. The conservatives should be embarrassed, but they're not. Which in and of itself says a lot about the conservative movement and its policies and its position and its priorities more than I could ever say. And if that isn't true, then I ask you once again, what's the number of black folks in the House of Representatives and the United States Senate who have an R behind their names? Tell me that number once again. Look, I don't very often speak ill of the dead, but Jesse Helms is an example that he was a bad man. He was a very bad man. He's a man that stood for hate. He stood for bigotry as much as any American politician ever did. And if you believe in an afterlife, you have to believe that Jesse Helms will be in the hottest place in hell. You know, from the very beginning. Let me read you a couple of things out of the L.A. Times. From the very beginning, Helms was schooled in the political device of using race to propel white conservatives to the poll. Am I going to sit here and say good things about him after that? Am I going to sit here and say good things about a racist? And am I going to sit here and say things about a man who would have put down the black people in the South and did? And never apologized for it? Never apologized for it. That's the point here. Never apologize. There were people that who were racist, who were raised that way, said things, did things against minorities, but saw the light and apologized and saw the error of their ways. Jesse Helms never did. Let me quote him once again. White people, wake up before it's too late. Do you want Negroes working beside you, your wife, and your daughters in your mills and factories? And he passed out a handbill showing his opponent's wife dancing with a black man. He was always talking about Pinkos and Yankees in Washington, and he criticized Martin Luther King's inner circle of civil rights leaders and called them said they had proven records of communism, socialism, and sexual perversion. He railed against Social Security, called it nothing more than doles and handouts. In 1972, pitted in against a Democratic congressman from Durham, Helm used a code word that enraged liberals. The congressman's name was Nick Galifianakis, and Helm's slogan was, "Elect Jesse Helms. He's one of us." And his next big challenge was in 1984 from moderate Democrat Jim Hunt, a popular two-term governor who was points ahead in the polls a year before the election, and then Helms launched his filibuster against the King holiday, the Martin Luther King holiday, a tactic that proved so popular in North Carolina that Hunt's lead was cut in half. So, celebrate, if you will, the passing or honor, I'm celebrating, but honor him, if you will. A man like Jesse Helms deserved no honor. He had no honor. And if talking ill of the dead is a real bad thing, well then, bad on me. But I don't care. I call it like I see it. And Jesse Helms was a very, very bad man. 866-546-5254. I see Henry Waxman is threatening to cite Attorney General Mukasey for contempt if he doesn't give up this interview with Dick Cheney. And he told Mukasey, "I'm not going to ask you anymore for the interview with Bush." Kind of doing that in a conciliatory manner, you see. So we'll get some cooperation from the White House. Henry, once again, bend over, grab your ankles. Henry, you're not going to get anywhere with these people. What do you have to do to understand that? What has to happen? Harriet Myers, Karl Rove, ever threatening to arrest Karl Rove? I'll believe that when I see it, huh? Ah, yeah. Well, what are you going to do, Henry? You going to ground him? You going to send him to bed without supper? Has there ever been an executive branch administration that's ever looked at the United States Congress and said, you know what, boys? We're going to do whatever we want to do. We will break the law. We will stretch the law. We will lie. We will cheat. And we will steal. We'll kill. We'll kill thousands. We'll kill hundreds of thousands. And we'll lie to you about it. We'll out a CIA officer. And we'll lie to you about that. And if anybody gets caught, we'll pardon them. But boys and girls in the Congress of the United States, we really don't give a damn what you think. You see? Are you getting it, Henry? Are you getting it now? We don't care what you think. And you can subpoena us, and we'll tell you where to stick your subpoena, Henry, because that's what we've done so far. And all your little subpoenas and all your little speeches that you've given have meant nothing to us. We got you. I don't think there's ever been an administration that's tried that before. Oh, yes, there's been some stonewalling here and there. Nixon was pretty good at it. But Nixon was an amateur compared to these folks. I mean, they have utter contempt for the Congress of the United States. And Karl Rove, the other night, well, we're going to arrest him. Yeah. When donkeys fly, they'll arrest Karl Rove. Well, I think we ought to pause for a quick break, and then we will come back with our guest in just a moment or two. Stay with us.
John McCain has done more than just embrace George Bush's failed policy in Iraq. It's actually his idea to escalate the war there. It's John McCain's idea to send tens of thousands more soldiers to Iraq and to keep them there with no timeline for bringing them home. The McCain plan to escalate, going from bad to worse.
Just a tactic to pull the wool over our eyes. The future isn't certain. There's man behind the curtain. He hides behind his clever disguise. For peace to prevail, the truth must be unveiled. And I'll feel much better when George Bush is in jail. Poor Dick Cheney with a smirk on his face is laughing all the way to the bank. His Halliburton stock has gone through the roof. There's oil for Humvees and tanks. For peace to prevail, truth must be unveiled, and I'll feel much better when Dick Cheney's in jail. What have they done? The king's cronies, the idiot son, a new world order's begun. Lord, forgive them.
just be a bed. And I'll feel much better when George Bush is in jail. What have they done?
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Guy James Show. We're glad you're along with us this afternoon. It's kind of a little bit of a cloudy afternoon here in Southwest Florida. I hope it's nice where you are today. As promised right now, I've got a gentleman on the phone that I've been looking forward to talking about. As you know, we've talked about this subject enough. I've got Chris Gunn with us, Communications Director for the American Small Business League. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hi, Guy. Thanks for having me on.
Very good to have you along with us, and we wanted to bring you on today as an expert in a subject that we've often discussed here. Mr. Bush and his appointees to the SBA and how the SBA perhaps is not the organization it once was. If you would, could you explain to our audience what your particular complaint and problem is with the SBA right now?
Certainly. As an organization, we take a pretty hard look at the diversion of federal small business contracts to large corporations and the Bush administration's continued, I suppose you could say, support of that diversion through its policy decisions and through its appointments. And what we've actually seen is just as recently as 2 weeks ago, actually, Sandy Baruha became the third nominee to the position of SBA administrator by the Bush administration. And he's also, kind of follows along the lines of typical Bush administration appointments in that he doesn't have any small business experience, and he really doesn't appear to have the type of experience that we think that he should have in regards to actually solving a lot of these problems that we've been looking at.
Have you been able to trace what connection he has, why he was appointed, what kind of a crony is he to the Bush administration?
You know, I think he's been around for a while. He's been in the Department of Commerce, working within a sect that deals with economic development for some time. So I think that he's definitely been around, and I think that that's part of the reason for his appointment. We were actually a little bit surprised that he was appointed, actually, given the fact that there really is less than 7 months left in Bush's term, and by actually bringing on another SBA administrator, we have some pretty serious questions as to whether or not he'll actually be able to get anything done during his time with the SBA. And given the fact that my understanding is that Senator Kerry Representative Velasquez are taking a pretty hard look at it. I think that we're going to be looking at kind of a elongated period of time before he's actually confirmed. So, we question whether or not he'll actually be able to get anything done when he's in office. And that very, very well may be a good thing, given the Bush administration's history of essentially propagating the diversion of federal small business contracts to large corporations. And we're actually concerned that by stepping in, the Bush administration is actually going to make some kind of move towards integrating the SBA with the Commerce Department, which, as you may know, actually happened with a large federal agency several years ago. And that was actually the agency that was specifically designed to help minority-owned small businesses. They were actually merged with the Commerce Department, went from a relatively large budget to a very small budget, and now they have a very small impact on minority-owned businesses. And that's a result of actually that merger with the Commerce Department.
Is this a position, and I don't know the answer to this question, maybe you don't either, is this position as head of the SBA kind of like the FCC that, Bush has worked hard to get his appointees in on the FCC, and when the new president takes over, he can't necessarily step in and replace him. The SBA, is this new fellow liable to be replaced when we get a new president?
No, that's a great question, and I think it's really going to depend on the actions that he takes during his first few months in office and whether or not people within the small business community are satisfied with this performance. I think that what we're really going to be looking at is a change of face depending on who we see elected. So if we see a McCain administration, then I think that we're going to obviously see him stick in that position. If we're looking at an Obama administration, I think we're going to be looking at change. And I know that that's been, kind of the cornerstone of his campaign thus far. But we've been in communication with Obama's Obama's campaign and talked about small business issues, and he's actually acknowledged the diversion of federal small business contracts to large corporations. So I actually think that when he comes into office, one of the first things that he'll probably take care of is actually addressing whether or not Mr. Bruha is actually doing the job that he was put in the position to do, and whether or not we need to take steps in a different direction.
Well, you know, the SBA isn't small business anymore, and that's really the point of what we're talking about here. It can be, but I don't think a lot of people understand the mission of the SBA. They have a certain amount of money appropriated each year, and when it's gone, it's gone. And large corporations step in and get a lion's share of the money, and that means Joe and Sally that wanted to start a small business down the street don't have the opportunity to get an SBA loan, and that's the big problem I see happening there right now.
Well, we're certainly looking at problems within the SBA loans. We're also looking at problems within federal contracting, which I think that is really even a bigger problem in that the federal government has a huge budget. They spend about $500 billion a year. Small businesses, by law, are entitled to 23% of that. There's a congressionally mandated 23% small business procurement goal. And small businesses just aren't getting that 23%. So I think that there's a perception that there's a lot of business out there, there's a lot of opportunity, and that small businesses can succeed. But when it comes down to it, the money is not going to small businesses. And as a result, we're seeing a lot of businesses go out of business. We're not supporting our middle-class economy. We actually contend that, the diversion of federal contracts to large corporations is actually part of a contributing factor in terms of our recent economic downturn. Because when you look at it, really, there are 400,000 small businesses that are registered on the CCR, which is the Central Contractors Registration Database. And those companies are receiving somewhere in the ballpark, or they should receive somewhere in the ballpark of something to the tune of $135 billion a year. Well, that's a lot of money going to the middle-class economy, and that's directly to the middle-class economy because of its nature, because it's small business. But when that money isn't going there, and we're talking about probably 50% of those funds are actually going to large companies, that's really going to take a hit on our economy.
Is that just the money being diverted, just a result of patronage down the line?
I think it's a result of a combination of factors. We're looking at companies that are large actually competing against smaller companies for federal contracts through what's called like NAICS code abuse, or North American Industry Classification code abuse, where say a company that is a company that exceeds the small business size standard for its typical industry would classify itself under a different industry so that it can compete against companies that are smaller for small business contracts. So say, for example, if you were a computer reseller and the small business size standard was 500 employees and you had 750 employees, theoretically you could classify yourself under a NAICS code that had a threshold of 1,500 employees so that you can compete with small businesses. And we've actually seen that happen in a number of cases, specifically with Government Technology Services Incorporated, which is GTSI, and several other companies. We're also seeing acquisitions of larger of smaller companies by larger companies. And by law, once you're acquired by a larger company, you're actually not a small business for the purposes of actually doing business with the federal government any longer. The cornerstone of the definition of a small business is actually independently owned and operated. And as a result, we're actually seeing companies that are, in fact, large competing with small businesses because there is a lack of oversight within the SBA. And they're essentially just, essentially kind of sliding under the radar.
What do you mean when you say small nowadays? When the SBA defines small business, yes, independently owned, but there's some huge independently owned companies. What kind of a range are we looking at?
It depends on the industry that you're in. So I think that, say, for example, and I always go back to this typically, but if you're looking at, say, for example, a small computer broker or a computer reseller, you're going to be looking at a situation where you're going to have 500 employees or less. If you are looking at a manufacturer of goods and services, you're going to be looking at a higher threshold of 750 or even 1,500 employees. And I would say that by most people's definition, those standards are probably too high. I would say that probably 90% of the cases, if I'm talking to someone and I say, what do you think is the appropriate size for a small business? And most people would tell me that it's less than 20.
Yes.
In most cases, you know, I would say that probably in a majority of those cases, they'd even say closer to 15 or 10, which I think is closer to the national average. I don't know if you have heard this or not, but 89%, or rather I'll say 98% of all companies have less than 100 employees. 89% have less than 20. And I think statistically, the averaging company has less than 10 employees. Nationwide, I think that goes the same for companies that are doing business with the federal government as well.
And the good part about that was it's safer actually to have more small businesses than it is a few large ones, because if we lose one large one, that hurts. But we've got all these small businesses out there. We're not going to lose all of our small businesses in one. One aspect of business or another, but I agree. I've talked to many people about this over the years. When you talk about 15, maybe 20 employees and all, that's my idea. That and smaller is definitely my idea of a small business, not somebody doing $50 or $100 million a year or up. I mean, who's responsible for that happening in the first place? I've known about the SBA for 40 years. In fact, I can tell you my brother and I many years ago went through the whole application process to do a golf course. And back in those days, it really was small business. How did this evolve the way it is now?
You know, originally we were looking at it's called a non-manufacturer size standard that was 100 employees or less, which I think is probably more appropriate. It should probably be less than that, but for the purposes of appeasing, you know, a larger group of people, would say 100 employees is probably the most appropriate. But I guess, you know, and this is what I've heard. Apparently, what happened was during the Reagan administration, they actually changed the non-manufacturer size standard to 500 employees or less through an illegal change. And the loophole that they used, they actually said, well, there's no size standard for non-manufacturers. And as a result, they just made one. And so in a typical situation, they would actually have to put something like that out for comment. The public would talk about it. It would, you know, get a ton of buzz. And then, you know, they'd really determine whether or not that was something that would be good for small businesses, whether or not it would help small businesses, or whether or not it would really hurt small businesses. And it just didn't happen. So, you know, from one day to the next, it actually went from 100 employees to 500 employees because of an intergovernmental change. And it's our understanding that that was actually an illegal change.
I'm sure you have found, as I have found in talking to people over the years about this, since that has happened, a lot of citizens are completely in the dark and absolutely shocked when they find out what size the corporations are involved sometimes with the SBA.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in most cases, I'm talking to people, and they really have no idea. And in fact, even congressional staffers, in most cases, have no idea that this is going on, which is shocking because these are the people that, you know, are there to essentially legislate and protect small businesses, and they just don't know about it. Myself and our president, Lloyd Chapman, and another colleague actually spent more than a month in Washington last year talking about some legislation that, you know, we thought was going to have a profound effect on small businesses. One of them was dealing with annual recertification, which would actually, you know, boot out a lot of those companies that are getting small business contracts because of acquisitions. And the other one was a bill that would allow venture capital firms to participate in federal small business programs. And we spent a lot of time up there, and we carry around these booklets, and in the booklet we actually had lists of the recipients of federal small business contracts for 2005 and 2006. And at the top of those lists you saw companies like Battelle, BAE, Thales, Booz Allen Hamilton, Lockheed Martin, Battelle, and the list kind of went on, and we would drop these lists in front of people and they just were absolutely flabbergasted. They had no idea that these companies were actually receiving small business contracts and that they were actually, in some cases, even actively pursuing small business contracts and competing against companies that are legitimately small.
Yeah, I wouldn't, having had some experience with Battelle, I wouldn't, I was amazed to see their name on that list. You were speaking about H.R. 5819 and how that's going to affect small businesses?
Yeah, absolutely. H.R. 5819, and actually before that, it was H.R. 3567. Essentially two very similar bills. 3567 initially would have allowed a single venture capital firm to own a controlling interest. By law is 51%. It would actually allow those companies to own 51% of a small business and maintain small business status. That has changed in the most recent incarnation, which is, as you mentioned, H.R. 5819. But even this bill has its major downfalls in that it actually modifies the definition of a small business and that cornerstone of a small business as independently owned. It erodes it, and it actually allows large venture capital firms to own a substantial portion of a small business and then maintain small business status. We're afraid that it's setting a dangerous precedent for venture capital participation in small business programs, and it really could lead to some very dangerous things even outside of the SBIR program, even within, say, for example, the SBA's loan programs or even contracting programs like the 8A program, the HUD zone program, things of that nature.
Well, there's already a problem with that, isn't there? Where a large company can take over a smaller company that's involved with SBA, and the larger company will continue to draw the benefits, even though the company is now owned by a much bigger corporation. Isn't that the case?
Absolutely. Yeah. No. And I think what we're looking at here is we're trying to work towards stopping those large corporations, and we were typically talking about Fortune 500, Fortune 1000 corporations, and even companies in Europe like BAE Systems and Thales, which is a French firm, and Berman MV, which is a Dutch firm. We were typically looking at large companies. HR 5819 kind of allows the double dipping of small business programs by not just large corporations, but actually by venture capital firms. And I guess the idea is that venture capital firms will come in and provide these small R&D companies that specialize in research and development. They'll come in and they will give them a specific amount of money so that they can do work on specific projects. But by doing so, they're actually enabling that company, to access the resources of that venture capital firm. And they're giving them an advantage, a competitive advantage, over small businesses who are actually trying to compete for these SBIR grants. And so I think we're looking at a situation where, and I've talked to some small business owners about this who, have been competing for SBIR money, that they're looking at a situation where currently they're able to compete pretty effectively for SBIR grants, where they would receive maybe one in two of three. But with H.R. 5819, if it were to pass, and it's going to have to pass or something's going to have to be passed by September 30th, with that bill, they're actually looking at a situation where they may be, able to compete for maybe one in two of 20. And as you and I both know, small businesses don't have the time, the energy, or the resources to dedicate that much time and man hours to filling out a large solicitation or a grant proposal, just to have that shut down because they're competing against a company who really has a competitive advantage over them.
Oh, to be sure, a small company with maybe one lawyer on retainer, they don't have the possibility of competing with somebody that's got the fifth floor of a building, all attorneys and accountants and all. It's going to be discouraging and like you said, cost prohibitive to the smaller outfit. What can our listeners do to help with this situation? Who in particular do we need to speak to?
We need to speak with John Kerry. John Kerry is really one of the key elements to this puzzle. Either that or Olympia Snow on the Senate Committee on Small Business and Entrepreneurship. And I would encourage your listeners to actually visit our webpage, www.asbl.com. On the left side, we've got an action center there. And they can actually use the congressional contact portals within that page to write letters to Senator Kerry and Senator Snow and let them know that you're against modifying the definition of a small business as independently owned and operated to include firms that are owned and controlled by venture capital firms. We actually have some language on there as well that they can copy and paste in, so that they can have the description of exactly what we're concerned about in the bill and all of that. And I would also encourage your listeners to raise their concerns about Sandy Berruha and its potential for actually harming small businesses and small business programs even more than the Bush administration already has.
Well, in his particular case, we've got another attaboy brownie, good job brownie guy there. Somebody that just doesn't belong in that position. What is your feel right now? You mentioned Olympia Snowe and John Kerry. What is your feel for where this stands with their cohorts?
Within the committee, I think that there's been a general air of support for small businesses and support for the SBIR program, and I think that there is a large amount of opposition to this bill. The Small Business Technology Council, the National Small Business Association, and several other large small business groups have actually come out in opposition to this bill. So I think that we're looking at a situation where they're definitely aware of the fact that it's happening, but every single voice counts, every single letter counts. And I think a lot of times people think, well, if I write a letter to my senator, it's going to be read by some low-level staffer and they're not going to count for anything. But they're actually reading these letters. They're definitely paying attention, and your voice definitely can be heard in Washington, and we definitely need your help. And within the committee, I think that, we're going to be looking at a situation where, they may vote on this bill, and I think they may pass it, but I think they're going to strip it down a little bit. They're not going to go forward with the House bill. I think that hopefully they'll come into some compromises, but, at the very least, I hope that they don't try to change the definition of a small business in the Small Business Act, because it's really creating a dangerous precedent, really a loophole for venture capital participation in small business programs.
Is it pretty much put down party lines that you can see?
I don't think that it is. I think that this is kind of a bipartisan effort on this. Some of those issues, as you and I both know, are definitely split in that way. But this bill, I think, is kind of interesting in that we have seen support on the House side from Republicans and Democrats alike. However, we have seen the White House has actually come out in opposition to this bill, which is interesting. Given their past performance and actual policy history, but it seems that they're actually against this legislation for part of the reasons that we actually mentioned, actually eroding the definition of a small business. And then on the other side of that, I think that we're seeing some internal conflicts within the Democratic Party in that I believe that the bill was actually introduced by Nydia Velazquez, who is a power player on the Small Business Committee. And I really have a hard time believing that this bill would move forward without the help of Nancy Pelosi and the party leadership. So I think that we're seeing, some senior Democrats within the House of Representatives really pushing this bill. But I also see Senator Kerry and the Democrats on the House Committee or the Senate Committee on Small Business and Entrepreneurship, say, for example, Cardin, stepping forward and actually saying, this is not going to help small businesses. We need to take a hard look at this and maybe come forward with something that's, a compromise, but better for small businesses.
Well, there used to be the saying many years ago by folks from General Motors, as General Motors goes, so goes America. I think we see where General Motors is right now, and I think we should realize the fact that as small business goes, so goes America. And it's absolutely important and imperative that we work toward fostering a better environment for small business in this country, and I know that's what you folks are all about. Chris, I want to thank you so much for being on the program. The website, once again, is asbl.com.
Yes.
Chris Gunn, Communications Director. There's a lot of great information there. And Chris, I'd like to thank you so much for being on the Guy James Show today.
Hey, Guy. Thanks so much for having me on. Yep. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye now. Chris Gunn from the American Small Business League. And I find it shocking, and we've talked about this before on the program. I know a lot of people that have been involved with the SBA over the years and never have, I guess it's my fault for not exploring it further, never have I known anybody that wasn't a small business. Because as the SBA actually worked, is my understanding, if I can remember right, I didn't look it up again, but the local bank guaranteed the funds, and you did your SBA loan application through them. I'm talking about the contracts now for work and all that, but the loans you went through your local bank and they handled the paperwork and all that. It was a long, laborious process and all that. And at that time, the SBA did have a certain amount of appropriated funds every year, and when they were gone, that was it. And usually it was around June or July, and their funds were gone. So I've known lots of people that were involved with the SBA, and it is shocking now that if you look at the list of people that are involved with the SBA now, you will be surprised. There's some pretty big fish in the pond involved with SBA that have no business being involved either in contracts or in loans with the SBA. So hopefully, and it's one of those political things. Here we are again with a new political climate hopefully coming up. And Bush is making this new, Sandy, I don't know how you really pronounce his name, Baraha, whatever. He has no administration. Wouldn't you think that somebody going in as the head of the SBA would have at least been the head of a small corporation in Podunk, USA, somebody that would have had business, medium to small business experience and a lot of it, that would understand the trials and the tribulation of the small businessman and the hurdles the small businessman has to jump over just to survive. Wouldn't you think that's who it would be, rather than another political crony? They've awarded so much money to Fortune 500 companies, and it just shouldn't happen. And I'm so much against that. And I know all of you, if you dig deep into this problem, you'll be appalled. You will be appalled at where the SBA is right now. So this H.R. 5819 should be stopped, and I'm distressed that people like Nancy Pelosi and others within the Democratic Party are for passing it. We need to put a bug in their ear and let us know. You know, there's so many issues that come up like this. Oh, the SBA, that's not a sexy issue. That's not what's on TV tonight. That's not on the news. It's not in the newspaper. But it's so important. It's so important to the business climate of the United States. It's so important to Main Street USA. You know, General Motors doesn't have a store on Main Street USA. Joe and Sally do. Sal and Clothing. A guy does with the local hardware store. That sort of thing. That's the business climate that's really important in America, not the big box stores. I forget the number right now, but I think it is something like 98% of all American companies have fewer than 100 employees. Now you think about that. That's the backbone of America. Small business is the backbone of America. It always has been, and hopefully it always will be, unless it gets strangled, and that's exactly what big business is trying to do. And you know how that is. Walmart comes into a community and cleans out a small town, cleans them out of all their local business folks and all. That's where we're headed. There are many issues involved in that, not just the SBA, but it's a place where we've got to take the proper fork in the road when it comes to this. We have to protect small business, and we have to keep the big fish from completely eating all the small fish, or we won't survive. Life in this country won't survive the way we know it. If we just have a few companies controlling everything, they'll control the price of everything. There won't be any competition. And then they'll rob you for every nickel they can get. We need small business, and wherever possible, I try and use small businessmen for the things that I need, and I hope you will as well. Anyway, that's what this first interview was about today. And you're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. We're going to be pausing for news very, very shortly, and then we will. come back in the second hour and entertain your phone calls and anything else you'd like to do. You can call in if you've got an issue you'd like to talk about. Why, let's do it today, okay? You listen to the Guy James Show. We'll be back right after the news.
Listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Walmart is opposing former Arkansas police officer Jimmy Singleton's efforts to win permanent disability workers' comp payments after he was beaten and shot on duty. Ken Harper is Singleton's attorney.
I think it's an awful case for them to try to get involved in. Here we have an officer who's just doing his duty, actually putting his life on the line. He's beaten, shot, and left for dead on the side of the road. And the treatment that Officer Singleton has received from the Arkansas Workers' Compensation Commission, I don't think has been a whole lot better than the treatment he got that night, to be honest with you.
The case is being heard by the Arkansas Supreme Court. Some workers at Chrysler's Toledo North Assembly Plant say it's a living hell there because Chrysler and the UAW are not stopping repeated sexual harassment of workers. The Detroit Free Press reports that a federal judge and investigators have affirmed allegations from some workers that company and UAW officials turned a blind eye to the harassment and have failed to protect workers. The paper says neither Chrysler nor the UAW responded when asked for comment. 9 federal lawsuits have been filed against Chrysler for alleged sexual harassment at that plant, and there have been 45 civil rights complaints about it in the past 18 months. The diamond industry was shocked on Sunday when workers throughout western India rioted at diamond factories and attacked the homes of factory owners. 200,000 diamond cutters and polishers began a strike on Saturday, demanding an increase in wages. The workers currently earn the equivalent of $2 to $4 per day and are demanding a 20% pay increase. 90% of all diamonds are cut in India. Grocery chain Trader Joe's is being asked to help put pressure on wine vendors. Jesse Russell reports.
Trader Joe's has a record of providing employees with reasonable wages and a solid health benefits package above and beyond the industry standard. That's kept it out of the line of fire of union organizers. However, a recent incident on a vineyard could soon put pressure on the health-conscious retailer. On May 16th, a grape pruner died from exhaustion at a vineyard owned by the Franzia family. That's the same family that produces Trader Joe's Charles Shaw wines, a.k.a. Two Buck Chuck. The United Farm Workers are asking Trader Joe's to apply pressure on the vendor to enact worker-friendly policies. In a statement, Trader Joe's said the company already has a strict vetting process for vendors and that the incident is unrelated to the chain. Here is today's economic report. Who are the highest paid blue-collar workers in the United States? According to a new study released by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, it is elevator installers and repairers. On average, workers in the field of elevator installation earn an hourly wage of $32.69. And in that field, the highest paid elevator installers are in Nevada.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Hey, John, I just heard you got a new computer. Congratulations.
Thanks. It's the coolest thing.
What will you do with your old computer?
I don't know. I guess I'll just throw it away.
Well, my company just bought new computers, and we decided to donate the old PCs to a place that gives them to local schools. You could do something like that.
Seriously, who would want a 3-year-old computer?
Hey, it might be great for someone else. Computers can be refurbished and reused instead of ending up in the trash. By passing it on, you can help the community and the environment.
If you're replacing your company's IT equipment or you're finished using your personal computer, pass it on to a local organization that accepts computers. To learn more, log on to epa.gov/passiton. This message was brought to you by EPA, Dell, Intel, HP, NEC, Philips, and this radio station on behalf of EPA's Plug Into E-Cycling Partnership. EPA does not endorse any commercial services or products of these groups. For information on all partners, log on to epa.gov/plugin.
If you don't clean up your room, the Board of Health is going to condemn it.
The Board of Health doesn't even know about your room. What's more, they don't care.
You know, if you keep making that face, it's going to freeze that way.
Not unless you're someplace really, really cold. Actually, a lot of the warnings moms hand out are a bit exaggerated.
If you don't get your blood pressure checked, you could have high blood pressure, not even know it, and you could die from a stroke.
But she's right about that one. Fact is, high blood pressure contributes to 200,000 American deaths each year, and a third of those who have high blood pressure don't know it. If they did, it'd be simple to treat. Call the American Heart Association at 1-800-AHA-USA1 or visit AmericanHeart.org on the web to learn more. Better still, ask your doctor to check your blood pressure.
If you run with those scissors,
it's the least you can do.
James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Life, you hear me? Give my creation life.
So this was fun.
You're gonna like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Good countdown. Six. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You live in a restricted broadcast area.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Hey there. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us today. Hope you're having a good day wherever you are. Hey, before I get to the phone, I want to talk to you all about something just for a moment, okay? I'll get to the phones in just a couple of minutes. This flag pin thing, what do you think? I see all the Republicans say you can't be patriotic unless you... And now I'm not one to be pushed into anything. I'm especially not one to be goaded into something or shamed into something and all that. And that's not what I'm going to talk about here. Let's all get some flag pins, and let's wear two of them. One on each lapel, or two on one lapel. Let's everybody on the left wear two flag pins, or three, or four, or five. And that will mean that we're better patriots than they are, you see, by their way of thinking, by their very own way of thinking, by their very definition. They've set down the rules, the criteria for all this. You can't be patriotic unless you wear a flag pin. So I say, let's wear two or three or four of them. Let's just put those suckers all over so that we are real patriots. And those left wearing just one flag pin then could not possibly be a real patriot. So what do you think? I've got my flag pins ready to roll. I could get another one even. I got two. But it's just my little way of looking back at the Repubs, that, as Bob calls them affectionately, the Republicans and the neocons and all the people over there on the right saying, hey, buddy, you're no patriot. I've got two flag pins, you see. So that makes you... Hey, let's head on over to the phone. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hey, it's Kevin.
Hi, Kevin. How are you today?
I'm okay.
Good. What's up, buddy?
Yeah, one of the reasons why they're doing what they're doing with cutting out the Small Business Association and all that is to create a more predatory, you know, environment. And that's for the reason why... You know, the diminishing of the union movement in the past 30 years, you know, conservatives or neocons thrive on disunity.
They sure do. They sure do.
And okay. And this is why you've noticed even like in the workplace and stuff like that, there's more backstabbing, more backbiting, one rats out the other instead of more, you know, non-management, you know, being unified.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. And the disparity between management and labor now is wider than ever, and they run roughshod over the employees. The management doesn't get away with it. They know that there's no threat of a union in many cases even coming in. We're going to treat you the way we want to. We got far more where you came from. There's just no protection for the workers anymore, and you're right, the big predatory type companies, they're going to have their way with the American worker and with small business too. They're going to run them out, and they're going to, and that drives wages down. It's tough.
And you know, again, that's one of the reasons why I'm glad I moved back to New York, is because, you know, at least I'm protected to a certain, because New York City still has a lot of small business.
Oh yeah.
In spite of its huge Wall Street presence, you know, I feel so great. I don't have to set foot into a Walmart.
Do they even have one in Manhattan?
Well, Walmart would never set foot in the five boroughs because, yeah, you know, strong union.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
CompUSA was basically ran out of town in this city. Because, you know, they try to, because they're based out in Texas, and they try to bring that, you know, less than minimum wage nonsense here and teamwork nonsense and do one for the company. Yeah, and basically they were ran out of town.
The strangest thing here with CompUSA, they went out of business right after Christmas, and then, I don't know, maybe 2 months later they came back and went back right back into the old store and started up again. Odd situation.
They probably fired off all the workers and hired cheaper labor. That's why, like me, I tend to support like local electronic stores like J&R Music World. You know, I hope that's a free plug for them because they treat their workers better.
Yeah.
And it's a medium-sized business. They employ like a couple hundred, I think like 200 employees.
Man, you've got a lot of... I was in Manhattan not long ago. When was it? I don't know. 3 or 4 months ago. Anyway, all those little electronic stores, men are everywhere. I couldn't get over that.
Oh, yeah. Well, a lot of those tiny ones are rip-offs.
Are they?
Yeah, they are rip-offs.
They got one of those in every block, the way it seems.
Yeah, but I tend to go to, you know, I'm a loyal customer of J&R Music World. It's a New York institution. You know, Best Buy, well, if I can help, it will never get any of my money.
Yeah. Yeah, you heard what I said about them earlier.
Yeah,
that's their policy. They get your money. They don't want to give it back.
Mm-hmm.
Do you live in one of the boroughs?
I live in Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn. Okay, yeah, that's right. You've told me that before. Life is different in the boroughs of New York.
Well, Staten Island, you start to experience more mid-America, which is probably the most rural of the five counties that make up New York City. We call them boroughs.
Yeah. Well, it's surprising for someone like me, you know, I'm used to life around here, and so I go into Manhattan and I go, well, where's the grocery store? You know, where's the supermarket? Well, there really aren't any. They've got all these little corner stores, but you got to get out of Manhattan to find any of the big, you know, the big supermarkets.
Oh, they have them. You know, they have them.
Where did they hide them? They certainly didn't have any. Let's say south of Central Park. That's where I always stay, south of Central Park someplace. I just never did see.
Like around Union Square, there's a big, what's that, health, Whole Foods.
Oh.
Ever heard of them?
No.
Whole Foods is a common chain here in the Northeast. They specialize in basically healthy food.
I see.
Grass-fed beef, know, organic vegetable.
Yeah, okay.
That kind of thing, and they have Targets and stuff like that. They have your Targets and stuff, but
okay.
For the most part, people tend to shop local.
Yeah, because I guess in what do they call it, Uptown?
Yeah.
In Manhattan, there aren't a whole lot of those type of things right from there south down to Wall Street, I guess. Mostly the little stores and, well, the big guys, too, the big department stores and all. I can't think of them right now, Bloomingdale's and Saks Fifth Avenue and all that. It's different there.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, again, it's like I thank God every day that I came back.
Yeah.
You know, 'cause it's like, yes, it's an expensive city to live, and you're taxed, and you pay a lot of rent. But at least you can budget that within up front.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? Like, again, when I was living in Florida and other states, it's the hidden cost that gets you.
Oh, yeah, Florida. Yeah, a lot of people around the country, a lot of you live in different states where you may have a state income tax. Well, Florida does not have a state income tax.
Yeah, but it hits you with everything.
They will beat you to death with every little other thing that they find. They more than make up for it, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they sure do. You have a state income tax in New York, right?
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
A very large one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when I lived in Ohio, we had a state income tax as well. But, yeah, in Florida there isn't one, but, man, they get you. They get you anyway. What did you think about this? Did you hear about, I wanted to ask somebody, I hadn't mentioned on the program yet today, did you hear about this 60-year-old librarian that was going to a McCain function yesterday, and she had a sign, and this is all it said on it. All it said on it said McCain equals Bush. And they considered that a threatening insult, and they had her thrown out and arrested yesterday.
Well, anything to a Republican that tells them what they are, it's a threat.
Well,
and it's treason.
But my goodness. To have McCain equaling Bush, I mean, Bush is the president of the United States. What would be insulting about that to a Republican to be equal to the president of the United States? That gives you some ideas to the state of their party right now. I was fascinated by this.
Well, you look at the same party who wants ex-con to easily be able to get a gun now, but not be able to easily vote.
Yeah. I just
that's
true.
Power.
That's true. And see, we may have a problem with voting this year because of all the displaced people having their homes foreclosed. A lot of people moving, many more than usual this year, and you know, having to re-register and all that. And as you well know, that may be the last thing on a lot of people's minds after they've been thrown out of their homes. So they'll go to vote and they won't be able to.
Divide and conquer. And, you know, the one thing I have to add, you know, with the neocon, because a lot of, like, Tom Harden think, okay, they can always, you know, build gated communities and all that.
Yeah.
And, you know, live amongst themselves and keep everyone out and all this nonsense. You know, I don't know, this is a little known historical fact, but the gated community was invented in the Belgian Congo. The concept of gated communities,
mm-hmm.
back in the late 40s, early 50s, I don't know exactly when. Look what happened in Belgian Congo.
Right. Well, and for good reason they had them. They would have been driven out and killed, and probably rightfully so.
It was invented either in Belgian Congo or French Algeria.
Mm-hmm.
To keep the natives out and keep...
Yeah. I noticed last time I was in Charleston, South Carolina, some of the old mansions south of Broad Street, they have broken glass and wire on the top of the walls that surround their houses, so nobody could climb the walls, and you know who they were trying to keep out. Yeah, the people always wanted to protect themselves against the other. Yeah, we are, as humans, we are. We're certainly flawed, that's for sure. Kevin, thanks so much for calling today. Good to hear from you once again.
Okay, then.
Always good to hear from you.
Okay, then.
Thanks.
Okay, bye.
Yeah, did you hear that story? Did you hear the story about the 61-year-old woman? Now, what I want to know is, you could see the sign two ways, could you not? There's only two ways you could see the sign. McCain equals Bush. If you were a good, proud Republican... And you had voted for Junior Bush twice, as most of them did, what would be the insult in having Bush equal McCain, your candidate that you have now? Wouldn't you be proud? If you're proud of your party and you're proud of the job that Junior Bush did, where's the insult in a sign that says McCain equals Bush? Hmm? Would they have thrown this woman out for holding up a sign that says McCain equals Reagan? I think we all know the answer to that. So, despite the fact that most of them won't admit that Junior Bush is a pariah to the Republican Party, an enigma, here we are, them throwing a 60-year-old woman out of one of their, a 60-year-old librarian. And I saw the video of the whole thing, and you can as well. I think it's on, where is it? Progress Report? It is a shame. Woman wasn't doing anything. She wasn't loud. She wasn't hurting anybody. She was holding that sign. She was very respectful. But they wanted her out of there. McCain equals Bush. So there you go. They had two ways to look at that sign, and they looked at it in a negative way, and I don't understand if they're so proud of their party and they're so proud of the man that's leading their party right now. I don't understand. I really don't. And have you seen this abracadabra presto changeo budget of John McCain's? If any of you understand that, please let me know. If any of you see any specifics in it whatsoever that would explain what he's going to do, and in terms that any layman could understand, in terms of any economist that could understand, let me know. He wants us to stay in two wars, and he wants us to probably get in a third war, especially if him and his and Bush and his good buddy, his shadow, his little peon pal, Joe Lieberman, if they all get their way. And God, aren't you sick of seeing Joe Lieberman standing over McCain's shoulder everywhere? If he's doing that to piss people off, it's working. Because I certainly am. I want to puke at the sight of Joe Lieberman. Anyway, don't get me sidetracked here. McCain wants to cut more taxes for the rich. Yes, indeed, he wants to do that. He used to be against cutting taxes, you know, back when he was a maverick. And he's saying that we're going to go back to maybe the surpluses we had during the Clinton administration when Bill Clinton was in. And he's got this budget out here that we're all supposed to listen to, and we're also go, ooh, wow, isn't that something? And yet there's nothing that he can explain in it that makes any sense. It's just more of the old tired rhetoric that you get in an election year. But McCain, you say you're going to have these huge tax cuts, and you're going to pay for them, and I hope you've all seen this. He says he's going to pay for these tax cuts. And by the way, 75% of them are for the people making over $250,000. Doesn't that sound familiar? More tax cuts for the rich. Screw the little guy. One fourth of the tax cuts for people making under $250,000. What is that? 90% of the people will get one fourth of the tax cut. And don't give me that old crap about the rich people making all the money, so they should get all the tax cuts. I think you know where I stand on that. But please tell me once again, Mr. John Sidney McCain, if you're going to have these huge tax cuts, how are you going to pay for them? Well, I already know. I've heard you say that you're going to pay for the tax cuts by using the reductions in costs for the Iraq War. This is the war you said is going to last 100 years. Are you going to wait 100 years for these to pay for these tax cuts? And correct me if I'm wrong, but the Iraq War, according to everything I know, the Iraq War isn't using money we have. It's using money we are borrowing. Now, I'm limited to elementary economics in high school and in college, but I don't know. It just makes sense to me. If we fund the tax cuts with money we're currently using for the war, wouldn't we be borrowing that money too? I'm a bit confused. We're using borrowed money for the war, and he says he's going to pay for his tax cuts with the money we save in Iraq and Iran. Wouldn't we be borrowing that money too? Because if there's a reduction in the cost of the war, if it ended altogether, we wouldn't have to borrow any money from China. Then we'd be flush, you see. And so then, where would the tax cut money come from, Mr. McCain? Do you think anybody's thought that through? It's one of the most absurd things I think I've ever heard. And yet, there'll be approximately 50 million people that'll go out and pull the lever for John Sidney McCain thinking, he's going to give us a tax cut. And I don't have mine now. I don't have my prosperity now, and I'm not rich yet, but I'm going to be. Because I'm a Republican, and I've been for Ronald Reagan, and I've been, you know, all them people, they stand for individual prosperity, and I'm going to, you know, they sound like these preachers. Have you noticed all these preachers, these evangelists going on selling this doctrine of prosperity now? The word is, I saw, the latest one. Hagee's been preaching it, Oral Roberts Jr.'s been preaching it, Benny Hinn, all those guys. If you send me $10, you'll get back $1,000. God will send you a check. Have you seen that? That's what John Sidney McCain's budget sounds like. We're living on borrowed money, but we're going to have tax cuts. And I don't know. I just, it makes me dizzy. He, if he gets elected, and stop, think about this, what McCain has already promised. This is what he's already promised. He's promised to solve Americans' immigration problem with, to quote him, tremendous improvements to border security infrastructure and increases in the Border Patrol and vigorous prosecution of companies that employ illegal aliens. He's promised us that. He has said he's going to revolutionize the decades-old Social Security system without jeopardizing the benefits, while simultaneously introducing individual retirement accounts. He's going to bring America to the precipice of independence from foreign sources of oil, because all we have to do is drill and our problems will be over with. You know, gas will go down to $1 a gallon and we'll have all we ever needed. He's going to shepherd the world through an era of low global inflation and a much improved quality of life. This is his promise. These are his promises that I'm quoting. He's going to cure global hunger by ending the current world food price crisis. He's going to upend America's system of taxation by implementing a flat tax. He's going to use Russia and China to pressure Iran to abandon its nuclear ambitions and North Korea to discontinue its own. He wants to kick Russia out of the G8. And by the way, he also says he's going to win the war in Iraq, stabilize the greater Middle East, and have American health care better than any time in history, all within a balanced budget. Man, when you look at that whole list, there's nothing left to accomplish. Hell, if he can do all that, I think I'll vote for him. If he can do what he promised that he'll do so far, I mean, who wouldn't vote for him? But everybody isn't voting for him, and you know why. Because you know that big long list of things he promised you is nothing but BS. What do you ever get from a Republican administration that they promised you? Think back when Junior Bush took over. Did he promise you a war in Iraq? Did he promise you that food costs would skyrocket? Did he not promise you, did he not tell you that since he and his family and Dick Cheney were good friends with the Saudis and the oil-producing, and many of the oil-producing countries, that they would know how to deal with them, that he could go over and tell them to turn on the spigot? Did he not tell you that? If you're a Republican, don't deny it. You know he did promise that. He did tell us that. What else did Junior Bush promise? Did he promise us that the dollar was going to go to hell in a handbasket? Once again, as I've always said, the Republicans are masters at getting elected. They are so good at politics. Governing? That's another matter altogether. Another matter altogether. We're going to pause for a break right now. We'll be back in just a minute or two. I wonder if you heard this story about American Airlines today. Oh, I've got a ticket to go on to American Airlines before long, and it bothers me. Here you go.
Well, a new survey finds summer travel is a mess. The flight tracking service, FlightStat, says 30% of all airline flights were late or canceled last month. Average delays ran over an hour. Meanwhile, in Miami over the weekend, a late flight crew sent passengers into a flying rage, Joel Brown reports.
It all started Sunday night when passengers say the flight crew showed up over an hour late for American Airlines Flight 1901. The passengers were upset, and they let the crew know it.
And when the crew got there, they were late, and everyone started to boo them. And then they closed them behind glass doors, and they kind of threatened us that they weren't going to fly because of the way people were acting. Some people got very agitated.
The crew says the passengers did more than boo. They got downright hostile.
I wouldn't think they were hostile. You know, they booed because they were an hour and 15 minutes late. When you want to leave at 9:45, it's 11 o'clock, they show up, so obviously people are a little upset.
The crew refused to fly, and when American couldn't find another crew, the flight was canceled, and the passengers were put up for the night.
They gave us a hotel and all that, but the hotel we stayed in had barbed wire all around it. Nice place. Nice hotel, but barbed wire around it.
They finally got to New York's Kennedy Airport late Monday night, but to add insult to injury, luggage went to LaGuardia Airport, 12 miles away.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come and saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers played the tree.
There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 1917. I was lying in a burned-out basement with a full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the skies. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. Thinking about what a friend had said, I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceships flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and banners flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream. All in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
We now continue our coverage of our top news story this morning, President Bush's tour of America to survey the damage caused by his disastrous presidency.
Right, Tracy, here's what we know so far. The presidency started and hit America at around 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time back on January 20th, 2001. Now, so far, that presidency has caused some $9 trillion worth of debt. It's left thousands of people dead, and still, even this morning, it continues to rage on. We have some footage to show you here of some of the survivors.
Well, I didn't think it was going to be this bad.
Arkansas has never seen nothing like this. This ain't the country. This is state.
He needs to see how bad it is down here.
You know, it's so sad. You can actually hear the fear in their voices.
Yeah.
The sheer destructive force of Bush caught people completely off guard in a lot of cases.
Well, joining us now live is Brian Scott. He's been following the president on his tour of the disaster area. Brian?
Tracy, President Bush has been showing real leadership out here. Yesterday, he started the day with a flyover tour of Kansas. Of course, that's one of the 50 states in the direct path of this presidency.
Yeah.
And then he stopped in Denver to deliver a very moving speech that offered as much encouragement as he could to the approximately 300 million people whose lives have been completely torn apart by him.
You really have to admire the strength he's showing in the face of all the adversities he's created.
Bush later met privately with a group of victims and personally assured them his administration would not abandon them as they seek to rebuild their lives in the wake of his administration.
Unbelievable.
We have a clip from that speech,
yeah.
So we should give a look and a listen to it right now.
I'll be seeing people whose lives were turned upside down. I'll do my very best to comfort them. I ask our nation, for those who are prayerful, to give a prayer for the victims.
And the president said he has been praying every night that he doesn't do any more damage than he's already wrought on the country.
Have there been any actual relief efforts started for the Bush victims?
From what we understand, some U.S. citizens were able to evacuate safely to Canada and take refuge there before the worst of this presidency hit.
Very good.
There's also been a huge outpouring of sympathy from overseas for those millions of Americans who were not able to get out of Bush's path of time.
It's just so upsetting.
Now, you see here in this footage, people hoarding food, boarding up their houses.
Yeah.
They've said, some of them, they're not going to come out until the entire presidency has passed.
Now tell us, what has the president's emotional response been to all this?
Well, Tracy, he cares deeply, no doubt. You can see just by the look on his face, he did truly love America, and to see that he all but destroyed it, I think it's just very hard on him.
Yeah, I have to say, this might be one of his finest moments as president.
You know, I think history may bear you out on that, Tracy.
Welcome back to the Guy James Show. Glad to have you along with us this afternoon. Hey, what do you think about this deal about Barack Obama going to give his acceptance speech at Bronco Stadium? That's quite a development, and let me tell you why. As you probably know, the networks go to the convention hall, the Pepsi Center, and set up miles of cable and cameras everywhere, and their portable studios outside the place and trailers and all that. It's quite an undertaking to cover a convention. And they're all set up, and they'd planned this for months now, how to cover this thing. And all of a sudden, Barack Obama says, well, I'm going to do the acceptance speech over at Bronco Stadium, so y'all have to come on over there on the last night, on Thursday night of the convention, and set up and cover that. Man, you talk about some scrambling. Ooh, how'd you like to be one of the network execs and have to, the producers, and have to figure that one out? Now, where this comes in for yours truly is I am going to be doing my show from the Democratic Convention on the 25th of August, 26th and 27th. I don't know about the 28th, having had it moved out to Bronco Stadium, but we will be doing the convention, and we'll be live from the convention on the 25th. Let me look at the calendar here. Yeah, 25th, 26th, and 27th of August. So that's a Monday, a Tuesday, and a Wednesday, and we're not sure yet about the final night. It depends on the logistics of the situation there. But we'll be doing the show live from the Democratic National Convention. I've not done a show from the convention. It shouldn't be any big deal setting up and doing it remote. The reason I brought this up, and a good bit in advance, is we certainly could help use some assistance to defray expenses for that whole business. And if you'd like to help out with that, why, you can go to theguyjamesshow.com and do so right there. And this is a listener-supported program, and if you'd like to support any of our endeavors, like going to the convention or keeping the show on, why, we'd appreciate it very much. That's www.theguyjamesshow.com, and we've got that one coming up in August. All right? But Obama, John Kennedy was the first one to ever do this. He did it in 1960. He went to the Los Angeles Coliseum. Yeah, I almost forgot where it was. The Los Angeles Coliseum has a big old place, and John Kennedy gave his acceptance speech there. And this one's going to be take place on the 28th at Mile High Stadium, home of the Denver Broncos. And the rest of it, the 25th, 26th, and 27th, is going to be at Denver's Pepsi Center, which holds about 21,000 people. So they've all got it all set up, everybody except the networks, I imagine, who are, as we speak,
scrambling to figure out how much more that's going to cost them. You have to move to a totally different venue the next night. At least it's in the same city.
Now, something I wanted to bring up, I want to see how many of you are as much of a cynic as I am these days. It seems that no matter what I see on the news now and nowadays, I have a hard time buying a lot of it. What do you think the chances are that down in South America, in Colombia, a group of people have been hostages for 5 years or more, some of them longer than that, and they happen to be released on the very day that John McCain comes to visit their country? Now, knowing that Junior Bush knew about this, and the Colombian government has admitted that Junior Bush knew about this 10 days ahead of time, what are the chances of John McCain going down there, you know, 5 years, 1,825 days, 5 years for some of these people, have been in captivity, and don't you know, the very day John McCain happens to drive into town, they let him go. Well, or they rescued him, or however you want to call that thing that took place. Thank God they're free. I'm very happy about that. But you don't suppose that Junior Bush, knowing about that 10 days ahead of time, probably got a hold of the McCain campaign, say, hey, buddy, here's a chance for a great photo op right here. If you get down there, that's going to make all of us look good. I believe that's what happened. I've read in foreign newspapers, certainly not in ours. I read in a Swiss newspaper and a German newspaper. Don't ask me to tell you the names of them right now. I can sooner or later. But they claimed that there was a big ransom paid for the people, and it wasn't all that much of an actual rescue, but actually a backstabbing capitulation by some of the FARC members that knew it was coming and were in on it. And I believe the Bush administration was in on it. I absolutely believe the Bush administration was in on it. Can't prove it, but like I said, I'm not a great one for big coincidences, and I think that one is about as good as they get, don't you? 866-546-5254. How many of you remember a speech a long time ago? I don't know the date for sure. But Junior Bush told all of American, told all we Americans, that if the Iraqis, an elected government in Iraq, asked America's troops to leave, that we would leave. And that's the only equivocation that he put on it, that it had to be an elected, legitimate government. Now, in the eyes of the Bush administration, they helped usher in this Maliki administration and saw to it that they had honest elections and open elections. And Maliki was their fair-haired boy. And they got him in there, and he's, according to everything that has been said by the American government, by the Bush administration, he is, Maliki, he is the legitimate leader of that country, the legitimate elected leader of that country. And Bush, in his speech, while always speaking out against withdrawal at the wrong time, has mentioned several times that we would pull out if there was a legitimate government that asked us to? And he's been asked that question, and that was his answer. Well, now we've got Prime Minister Maliki saying that this long-term security deal for Iraq that's still being negotiated has to include a pact. He said must include a pact that contains a timeline for a U.S. military withdrawal from his country. And he took office about 2 years ago, and he's not expressed any steadfast view for an American troop pullout. However, this latest development could set back this delicate negotiating that's taken place between U.S. and Iraqi officials. And as you know, Bush has frequently spoken out against any precipitous military withdrawal from Iraq, including, and always including, and being adamant about it, no timetable for withdrawal, fearing that to do so before the country is actually stabilized would leave it at the mercy of Al-Qaeda, according to Bush, you know. We don't believe that they'd be at the mercy of Al-Qaeda. We don't think Iran would allow that, and we don't think the Iraqi people would allow that, but Bush, you know, he keeps trying to push that. So Bush has said it, that if asked by a legitimate government, the United States forces would leave the sovereign nation of Iraq. And guess what? In 2004, John McCain, that's right, John Sidney McCain, admitted that we'd leave Iraq if the Iraqis wanted us to. That's right. The question was given at the Council of Foreign Relations. The question was asked, and let me quote the question, what would or should we do in the post-June 30th period a so-called sovereign Iraqi government asked us to leave, even if we're unhappy about their security situation there? And McCain said, and this is a direct quote from John Sidney McCain, well, if that scenario evolves, then I think it's obvious that we would have to leave. Because if it was an elected government of Iraq, and we've been asked to leave other places in the world, if it were an extremist government, then I think we would have other challenges. But this is a quote from John Sidney McCain, if the Iraqis ask us to leave, but I don't see how we could stay when our whole emphasis and policy has been based on turning the Iraqi government over to the Iraqi people. Those are the words of John Sidney McCain. Mr. McCain, do you still believe that way? Do you still believe that if the legitimate elected government of Iraq asks us to leave, that we should leave? I would like to be able to ask him that question this afternoon. I most certainly would. I think I know what his answer would be. He'd clear his throat a lot and say, well, I know I said that 4 years ago, but, you know, conditions have changed a little bit, and we're not. I don't know what'll happen there. Bush must be completely exasperated by this, because when you're a lame duck president and a prime minister that you installed in office, can't resist the temptation to, you know, give you the finger, which is exactly what that's what he's doing here. Bush is bound to have had a little bit of a struggle over this with Maliki telling him he wants us the hell out of there. I didn't want the day to go by without this. You know, we've been talking about health care for some time, and we've got a big program. A lot of the program coming up Thursday, I think, dedicated to it. Here's something on health care about the children in this country.
While Congress debates how to provide health insurance for America's 9 million uninsured children, a surprising study released today finds the vast majority of children do not want health care. Joining us now is the study's director, Gerald Fisher. Tell us about this study, Mr. Fisher.
Well, we surveyed over 2,000 children and found that across the board they were strongly opposed to doctor's visits, vaccination programs, and essentially every health care service some politicians are saying government coverage should provide.
Now, we're seeing those survey results here. You asked the simple question, would you like to go to the doctor more? The majority of respondents shrieked no.
Right. Leave me alone. Don't make me go. They were extremely passionate on the issue.
I see. Now, why do you think they feel so strongly about this?
Well, it's clear these children are worried that increased government funding for health insurance is a slippery slope to socialized health care.
So you're saying this is a political issue for them?
And a moral one. When we ask them if they see universal health care as an unfair burden to certain taxpayers and would they like a lollipop, almost all children said yes.
Really? This obviously comes as a blow to politicians who've been calling for universal child health care coverage.
No, exactly.
After the results of your studies, a majority of senators are backing a bill that will cut all public funding for children's hospitals. It would close approximately 9,000 of the outdated, unwanted facilities. Now, have you heard any response to this announcement from the children themselves?
Absolutely. The kids are thrilled, Andrea. They're saying, goody, I want to go home. Unplug me. I want to go to grandma's or the movies. Basically, they'd rather be anywhere but in those hospitals.
And it looks like they're going to get their wish. That's great to hear.
Still silver, it was back when the country was strong. Back before Elvis and before the Vietnam War came along. Before the Beatles and yesterday, when a man still work, still would. The best of the free life behind us now, and are the good times really over for good? And are we rolling downhill like a snowball headed for hell? A chance for the flag of the liberty bell. I wish a Ford and a Chevy would still last 10 years like they should. It's the best of the free life behind us now. All the good times really over. Wish Coke was still cola, and the joint was a bad place to be. And it was back before Nixon, life was all on TV. Before microwave ovens, when a girl could still cook, still would. Best of the free life behind us now. Are the good times really over for good? I've been rolling down a hill like a snowball headed for hell. With no kind of chance for the flag of liberty. Wish a Ford and a Chevy would still last 10 years like they should. Is the best of the free life behind us now? Are the good times really over for good? life is still yet to come. Good times ain't over for good.
Well, we hope not, anyway. We hope not. We're taking a slight hiatus here from the good times. Things will slow down the country, and there's a lot of folks very much upset right now, tremendously disturbed because having financial difficulties in the housing market and the job market and all that. But we'll rebound. We'll rebound. We hope. We hope the good times are not over. But there is this in the news today, and I found this absolutely frightening. It is, however, something that I'm sure Junior Bush and Karl Rove and Cheney, especially Cheney, would love this. A senior government official with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security has expressed great interest in a so-called safety bracelet that would serve as a stun device similar to that of a police taser. According to this promotional video found at the Lampert Less Lethal website, the bracelet would be worn by all airline passengers. The bracelet would take the place of an airline boarding pass. It would contain personal information about the traveler, be able to monitor the whereabouts of each passenger and his and her or her luggage, shock the wearer on command, completely immobilizing him or her for several minutes. The electronic ID bracelet, as it's referred to as, would be worn by every traveler until they disembark the flight at their destination. Yes, you heard that correctly. Every airline passenger would be tracked by a government-funded GPS containing personal, private, and confidential information, and that it would shock the customer worse than an electronic dog collar if he or she gets out of line. When I first read this, I thought, well, now that's a joke. Turns out it is not. I would like to find a Department of Homeland Security official to come on and talk to us about that, but so far I have not had any luck, and I guess for good reason, who would want to talk about that? But isn't it just more of the same for this administration? A Homeland Security person expressed interest in a device like this that would shock you and have your private information on and all that. And then there was the story about the military blogger. On June 26, a suicide bomber attacked a meeting of tribal sheikhs in Iraq, in the Anbar province, and killed 20 people, including three Marines. And the episode was widely reported by U.S. media, and Zariah Miller, a photojournalist and blogger embedded with the U.S. Marines in Iraq, took pictures of the attack grisly aftermath, including one of the fallen soldiers. The U.S. military, however, was incensed at Miller's portrayal of the horrors of war and immediately disembedded him from his Marine unit. Yeah, because the rule is, there will be no photos of dead Americans with U.S. uniforms and boots. There will not be. They claimed he signed a contract for that. He said he never signed a contract for that. He wasn't showing identifiable features of a soldier, and they couldn't find a real reason to kick him out, so they made up a phony one and kicked him out for that, because he showed pictures of bodies and pieces of uniform and boots. So he's trying to get back. Imagine that. The United States military not allowing any photos. They have an embargo on any photos that shows the death of any Americans over there. Well, it's war, and it's ugly, and we certainly would not want the people in America to see how ugly it is, now would we? We certainly wouldn't want the people in this country to understand that there are some of our young men and women getting killed every single day, almost every single day over there. We wouldn't want them to see that. It would just be a little too hard for them to take, and so they kick this guy out of Iraq. That's the way it is. Hey, thanks for joining us here today on the Guy James Show. We'll be back with another program tomorrow. We hope you'll be here as well. We're a proud member of the Head On Radio Network. Billy Shears.